Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
In this episode of Lifetimes, we hear from Colin Jackson, one of Britain's greatest athletes and someone with a fascinating backstory.
Away this time, and Ross has got away well, and so is Colin Jackson in the centre, and Garcia's been left at the moment, and Ross going, and Jackson coming through in the middle, and Colin's got away, and Colin, if he can hold it here, Garcia coming through, but the final stages, he's got to get there, and Colin Jackson is
Jackson is away very well indeed. So too is Jack Pitt. Tony Dees next to him, and then Tony Jarrett. But Jackson is going clear. Dees is hitting hurdles. He's out of it. Jackson is clear of Pierce, and Jarrett comes up. And Tony Jarrett got the silver, but look at that for Colin Jackson, a British one too. And it's a world record of 12.91. Fantastic running.
That thing we were talking about a minute ago, you're 53.
52 now.
52, 53, let's get that right.
Next birthday then.
48.
February, yeah.
I mean, the fact that it's gone so fast, you're saying to me you think this is a positive thing. I think this is a negative. Life's disappearing before my eyes. You know, I'm going to be 60, then 70, and then goodness knows what's going to happen. You see this as a positive.
Well, let's put it this way. You're right. You will be 60, you will be 70.
If I survive.
Fingers crossed, right? Everything goes the right direction. That's exactly where it's going to be. But I think life goes by really quickly when you're busy. And I think we're fortunate enough that we're busy doing stuff. We get up in the morning to do different things. Yeah. There are so many people that go through this, their whole life existing.
Yeah.
I think we do a little bit more than exist. And that to me is really important. So I think we should embrace the fact that life is going past really well. And I'm looking at you from across this desk, and you... Listen, you don't look stressed, you don't look hassled.
Really?
You look pretty good, fella.
It's an act.
Is it?
But that thing you're saying there, Colin, about we've got things to look forward to, we're busy, got objectives, a reason to wake up in the morning. I totally get what you mean. And I think that if one didn't have those things, life would drag and it'd probably have less meaning. Mm-hmm. But did you find, because, you know, I played sport, table tennis, you were in athletics.
Many teams together.
Yeah, exactly. did you find that in sport there were big objectives, the Olympic Games, the World Championships, breaking a world record? Whereas after sport, those kind of epic targets and ambitions, they're not the same, are they?
No, you're right. And so I'm going to just break it down. If you can imagine, they're very different parts of your life.
Yeah.
And when you say never the twain shall meet, they meet because of history. That is the only thing, right? That's their meeting point. But everybody in, I would say, who's in a working environment would always change their careers a little bit. So that's all we've kind of done. We've just changed our careers. So we've
always
spent...
Is that how you really see it?
Yeah,
you don't
sure.
see it as like this massive watershed.
No.
Athletics and post-athletics.
Yeah, no. I think it's just, I'm just still the same person.
Hmm.
You know, I've not got quite the same body, but I'm just saying, but I'm the same...
It's still
same,
pretty
same,
good.
Same, I'm the same person. So what tend to happen was, if you think I only fell into athletics, I know that sounds bizarre, and I know you're looking at me already with raised eyebrows going, excuse me, but no, really, I fell into the sport of athletics. I was lucky enough that I loved it, and with loving it, I worked hard at it, and with the God-given abilities that I had, and all the help that I had from, you know, great coaching, master, blah, 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 you know, all those extensions that go with top and world-class sport, I was successful. So that was the positive side of it, very much. And then when you think about whether there's other pressures linked with the sport, like competing in the Olympic Games or World Championships, trying to set world records, all these things are part of that journey when you're good enough. I always tell people to make sure you have realistic goals that are right for the particular moment in time. So when I came into the sport athletics, you know, who knew what I was going to do? I would have never said, oh, I am going to be an Olympic champ. I am going to be a world record. Or I am. No chance. That was never me. All I ever did was just go, I like this. I hope it goes really well.
It's intriguing because a lot of people would assume that you had this blinding ambition and that you were driven by it from day one. But this was kind of almost like a random occurrence. And you grew up, so let's paint the picture. Yeah. You grew up in South Wales.
South Wales, yep. Of Jamaican parents.
So you're presumably unusual in your ethnic background.
For sure.
I mentioned this. I'm half Pakistani. Mm. I grew up in suburban Reading.
Yeah.
And, you know, I felt like a bit of an outsider. I grew up, like you, in the 1970s, and there was a bit of racism around. Paint a picture of what it was like growing up as you in that culture.
Okay, so in South Wales, initially, I think because you're very much part of... the Welsh people are very much community orientated anyway, and they embrace lots of things about you know, and I think I was really lucky that I didn't experience any particular racism in that sense. Apart from, you know, there was always going to be apart from on reflection, not at the actual moment. At that time, I didn't recognise it because I wasn't subjective to it.
Yeah.
But I remember when I was trying to play cricket, and I was playing cricket for the county in that sense. And I was a captain of our school. Mm-hmm. And five players from my school were named in the team. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't. And on reflection, I feel it was a little bit to the fact that perhaps my skin tone was not correct.
But it's fascinating. So I'm half Welsh. My grandfather grew up in the Rhondda Valley. He was a miner. My grandmother from Llangollen. And my mum, all of her family are in Wales. So I go there a lot. I get what you're saying about community. It's a wonderful, powerful thing, isn't it? People really look out for each other. It's neighbourly. Yeah. They know each other's names. But, you know, when I was growing up in Reading, I heard the P word a lot.
Right.
NF. Mm-hmm. You'll know what that means.
Yeah.
National Front. Were like that symbol. You would see graffiti in a lot of different places. When I went to my first football game, the P word was used when I was in the stands. So I was quite conscious of it growing up.
Yeah.
It's really interesting that you only became conscious of this one moment retrospectively.
Yeah.
But not at the time.
Yeah. No, definitely not at the time. And I think, I don't know whether... there was always that real community kind of feel, I think, always. Because all us as kids, we all play together. Mm. You know, it's a whole mix of kids there. And we'd be in each other's houses all the time. And there was never an issue. Nobody was ever saying, you get out. There was never that. Yeah. So, of course, if that's how you see life, of course, you're in these beautiful rose-tinted goggles, aren't you? In that sense. Mm. And it doesn't really, I guess, raise its ugly head until later on.
Yeah.
You know.
Okay, well, let's maybe go back to that. But your parents intrigued me. You say both Jamaican.
Both Jamaican, yeah.
Immigrant, first generation. Yes. Came to the UK to live, settled down in South Wales. Now, I know nothing about your parents except for the fact they brought up at least two remarkable people. So you have one sibling or more than one?
I have a half brother as well.
And your sister has become an incredibly successful actor.
Mm.
You've become an amazingly successful sportsman and you've done amazing. So tell me about the upbringing. I mean, these sound like they must have been pretty inspirational parents.
Do you know what? I think they allowed us to be kids. They really allowed us to do what we wanted to do.
Yeah.
And whatever it was, I don't think we are reflected, right? So I'm thinking really deep in, was there a magic formula that my parents kind of pulled together to make us the people we are? All I know is that they were very well disciplined. and they made
sure you had to behave.
Yeah, yeah. There was no two ways about it, and that was the same thing through the whole of the family. Mm. In that sense, huge amount of respect for everybody. I think this is one of the big things that were important to us is that having respect, I think, also made us humble in that sense. We didn't want for anything, you know, but we weren't spoilt. Do you know, it's that real fine line of not want. But I think
it wasn't a rich upbringing, was it?
No, we were up on a council estate in Cardiff, you know, but we had two cars. My mum and dad had a car, which meant it was easy for both myself and my sister to do things. So if I needed to go training, one would take us to training. If my sister had to go and do a performance, the other parent was out doing that. Mm. And so
they supported you, whatever you wanted to do.
Without question. You know, if we wanted to have a go at playing the violin or guitar, they go, okay, let's see if we can find a guitar or let's find a violin and give it to them to give it a go. There was never any, I don't think, and that sounds weird when I say, I don't think there was ever a no. You know, for having a go. Yeah. But we were decent kids. Mm. You know, we would never bring trouble to the house, as we'd always say.
So you're well behaved through school.
Yeah.
No delinquency, no getting chucked out of classes, detention.
I was cheeky. Yeah.
You're a bit
which I know that won't surprise you. I was a little bit mouthy sometimes in school. But I guess that kind of arrogance allowed us to become the champion I ultimately ended up being. Mm. But in the same breath, I was respectfully cheeky. So I would do things and I'd know my boundaries.
Yeah.
You know, I knew where my boundaries always lay.
And how do you fall into athletics? How does that happen?
You know, because I had nothing else better to do. Uh-huh. And that sounds sad, doesn't it, in that sense? But all I remember, my sister always had an ambition. She wanted to be a journalist, right?
Really?
So that's what she wanted to be. And when people say to me, well, what do you want to do then? And I was like, oh, those flowers look lovely, right? I had no idea. All I knew is that I enjoyed sport. Mm-hmm. I was a massive sports fan and I loved playing.
Yep.
So, you know, sport just seemed an ideal place to end up getting to. And so, yeah, I literally fell into my sport that way. But
At school,
I'd do everything. Mm-hmm. You know, whatever was available, I was there. You know, shot put, high jump, long jump, javelin, I'd do that. Cricket, I was in the national football team.
And you captained the cricket team.
Yeah.
By the way, this might be a glimmer of a memory, completely wrong. Did you start as a decathlete?
I did. Absolutely spot on. And then I realised there was this thing called the pole vault. Uh-huh. And I knew that was going to be a real struggle. And so did my coach, Malcolm Arnold, realised, like, I'm not sure if we're going to get to coax him to go further than 3 metres in the pole vault. So I only managed 2 metres and 72.
That's still pretty good. Malcolm Arnold, was he from South Wales?
Malcolm was based in South Wales. He's from Northwich, up in Cheshire. So, but he was based in South Wales. He was national coach for
Wales. Right. And so you came across him quite early.
15.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, 15.
Great coach.
Brilliant coach. Absolutely brilliant. I was terrified of him.
Disciplinarian. like Ferguson, the hairdryer.
He was always like, seemed gruff, right? And then when you get to know him, you realise that him and his whole family are lovely. Yeah. So it's just that he was a professional in his field. So, you know, was probably 3 or 4 times he said he threatened to throw me out of the group for not doing what I was told. But when you're young, you kind of, as I said to you earlier, I push those boundaries. Yeah. you need to know. But it was always really interesting to when I came across Malcolm as a coach, because he was one of these people who always laid, like my parents in a sense, laid responsibility at my door.
Yeah.
So he's only going to guide me. That's it, full stop. Whatever it is, down to you, sunshine. Yeah. So I remember posing a question to him later on, and I know we're jumping around a little bit here, but I think it's kind of relevant when I posed a question to him, and I said to him, did you think I'm going to be as good as I ended up being? Mm. And he went, no. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, when you start, he said, no. He said to me, no, I didn't think you were going to be as good as you ended up being. And I was like, I was very confused in that sense. He said, you know, let's start with the fact that I have met in my life, now you think Malcolm's 76, far more talented athletes than you. Far more talented that didn't make it. So I thought, well, you knocked me down a peg or two, right? That didn't make it. He said, because it's not just about your athletic ability, which will make you a champion. He said, I didn't know what your background was, what your parents were like, whether you were getting the right motivation from a home, if you were still had aspiration, or if you were just here fly by night, if you were just doing it to fill in the time of leave. He said, so of course I would have no idea whether you could become the champion you ended up becoming. And you sit back and you think to yourself, wow, I'm not sure which part of that I like. Is that I'm not there as talented as he thinks or what?
But he's right though, isn't he? The talent isn't enough. Nope. You need to have that drive.
Yeah.
You need to take responsibility.
Because
it's really easy when you're being spoon-fed by a coach just to take the coaching, told where to go at the right time. But every now and again, you have to step up. And you have to say, I'm going to do that extra training session. I'm going to push myself that little bit harder.
Yeah.
I'm not going to eat the food that might compromise my development as an athlete. Can you think of a moment where you had that inner conversation and said, you know what, I'm knuckling down? Or did it happen more gradually than that? What sort of age are we talking, where you started to really...
Well, Malcolm first said that I had that conversation with me about being, you know, independent, et cetera, at 15, when I first joined his group.
That's interesting.
So as I joined the group, he told me this.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, right, okay. So you kind of already like thinking,
Do you know, I know this is slightly going off tangent a little bit, but there's a school. I went and visited a school not long ago near Croydon. And the teachers... You know, fantastic teachers really care about the students. And so if a student didn't turn up for class, they'd drive around to their home and make sure they were there. If they didn't understand something, they would sit and talk and discuss it and make sure they did it, the homework. And everything was done in a way that kids would leave the school with the best possible qualifications because they were surrounded by an incredibly extensive support network. And they thought this is a good thing. And looking from the outside in, it sounds like a great thing. But then they found something really odd. Once the students were out there at university or in the wider world, and they had to step up, take responsibility, make decisions, they were struggling.
Yeah.
And at university, you have to decide what lectures you go to. You have to write your own essays and all the rest of it. They were dropping out early. And so they said that we want people to have a support network, but not to be spoon-fed. They need to make independent decisions. Yeah. They need to use their own initiative from time to time. It's fascinating that Malcolm Arnold, brilliant coach, had that conversation with you when you were 15.
15, very, very early on. So he already set up, you know, what was going to be necessary if I was going to progress.
Yeah.
Because one of the things he always did, he'd never travel with us to race competitions. So the only time we'd see him be at major championships, and that was because he was on national coach duty. So that was the only time. So you'd only have to... So again, you were left on your own devices. His job was to get me to the best physical shape I possibly could. Then if there was things that were always slightly off or off kilter, if anything was slightly off kilter, he would recognise it and he'd be able to just talk things through to you.
Yeah.
And numerous occasions I'd say to him, because sometimes he just wouldn't say anything. You know, you do a run and then you'd be walking.
Feedback.
No, you'd be walking back with him after and he'd go, oh, I've got to get a new carburetor for the car and blah, blah, blah. I'm telling you this now, right? Yeah, oh, a new carburetor for the car. And I'd go, oh, Mal, Did you not just see that run there? He went, if I have something to say about it, I'll say it. You don't have to tell me. So if I'm not saying anything, it's absolutely fine. And sometimes you just go, oh, okay. And if you accept that, then it's easy. It's not, you know, and I watch some other coaches around. I think they're filling their athletes with so much information.
Yeah,
what are they retaining? Mm. You know, again, it's that sense of responsibility. So he'd ask me between, what are you going to concentrate on in this run?
Yeah.
You. Not what I wanted to do. What are you going to... You feel it.
Yeah.
You know where your mistakes are happening now. So you tell me what you're going to concentrate on and I'll look out for it.
And it's clear you had the maturity to take this pep talk from Malcolm Arnold at 15 and say, you know what? I'm going to meet my side of the bargain. You're going to nurture me. I'm going to step up and allow you to do that. Give the parents... who will have children, who are doubtless interested in sport, who are listening to this, what kind of commitment did you make? I mean, was it half an hour a day? Was it an hour a day? A couple of times a week? What kind of stuff were you doing in your sort of late teens?
Outside of school. And I was like that. The only extra stuff I was doing, my extracurricular stuff, as you can imagine, was stretching.
Yeah.
And I would do that for half an hour watching Coronation Street. So, because I remember I was too small. You know, I was tiny. You know, all my main rivals were 6'3", 6'4", and I stood at 5'10 and a half. And I was told quite early that if I got good range of movement, a lot of flexibility, it'll make me more agile over the barriers.
Yep.
And if you're more agile, you've got more chance. I thought, well, then I'll get more agile. And so first of all, I'll get my flexibility up and then increase your power by, you know, your weights, your circuit training, etc., etc. But I was still, when I was quite young, I was still relatively lazy, right? Because at this stage, it's not my career. It's not my business. It's just having fun.
Yeah.
So even getting to the World Junior Championships at 19, and going there as a leader, what people expect. I was ranked 7th in the world as a senior.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a reasonable player, right? In the sport there at the age of 19. It still wasn't, you know, very much a job. It was something that was filling in my day.
Yes.
Because I still, at that stage, didn't know quite what I wanted to do with my life.
So it was only when you turned 20 that it became
the
thing.
And I had one of those pep talks again from Malcolm, literally. I won the bronze medal at the World Championships in 1987. And he said to me then that your life's going to change from here on in. And I was like, really? How is it going to change? Because I'm still the same, you know, I'm still the same Colin that I was 2 weeks ago. Just because I got this bronze medal, how is it going to change? And he said, well, A, you're going to have more responsibility thrown on you because there's going to be expectation. Mm-hmm. The next thing he said, your pay packet is going to go up dramatically. And that will soon make you understand that you need to be a little bit more responsible.
Yep.
Because people are expecting you to perform. They're not going to give you a lot of money and think you can go away. Now, at that stage, you can imagine, Matt, at that stage, I'm laughing to myself. I was thinking, I was on £800 for a series of races. Not each race. That was my package. All right?
£800 for a series of races?
Yeah. So it's about 6 races, right, at that stage, going before I won that bronze medal.
Right.
And then the only way you kind of hopefully make a little bit extra was, you know, on expenses. So instead of you having when, and it was always, we do this all the time. When there was the times where the flights were overbooked and they'd say, right, does anybody want to get off? We'll give you an extra ticket and, you know, you can get on the plane. We'd be like, straight up, that's like £100 in your pocket, right? That's making a bit of cash there. So we were kind of canny in the way that we try and make a little bit of extra money. But I went from that £800, and I remember it was like 6 races, so it was a total, so it was like, oh, it's over £100 a race here, to £5,000 per race.
Wow.
So as you can imagine, straight away, you're like
100-fold.
So when Malcolm was saying your responsibility would change, and so when people then, again, I guess because I was disciplined and I was well brought up, I realised that if people are paying you that type of money, you better perform.
Right.
You can't go there and just pull on an expenses performance.
Yeah. It's got to be everything.
You've got to be up there.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times. in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Most people know that you had an absolutely stellar athletics career. I mean, you, from memory, you won the World Championships with a world record time. That time stood for years. You broke world records in, I think, was it 60-metre hurdles?
Yeah.
It stood for a very, very long time.
Still stands, yeah.
Still stands to this day. You've got the world record for the 60-metre hurdles. So you weren't just a good hurdler. You were one of the greatest hurdlers who's ever lived.
Yeah.
What was that experience like? Did you have public acclaim, people asking for autographs? What was that like? How did you deal with fame and celebrity? Try and give us a sense of what that was like.
I see that purity side of me. So I'm smiling already. And you can hear my voice that I'm smiling about it because it's brilliant. It was. It's absolutely brilliant. It's the best thing. You imagine being a superstar in the 90s.
Yeah.
It was just great, right? I remember I was going in, being invited to parties where Prince was going to perform with George Michael and all the, you know, the, I guess, the good and the great of Britain.
Yeah.
You were always there, you know, you were very much part of that scene. So it was great. But there was that other side where there's that sense of responsibility again and you, there's expectation.
So you stayed grounded.
Always.
Your head didn't get turned.
I'm going to tell you a story. I had to, because Linford Christie was around in those days, Sally Gunnell was around those days. So we were a kind of a trio, you know, that was, were everywhere. But I remember I was invited to race in Paris and initially, I thought, oh, I don't really want to go. But you know what? The guys say, you know, they'll look after us. So let me go. And the whole group are going. So Linford's going and the whole crew are going. So I said, all right, let's go. And they picked us up. And they took us to Hotel Crillon there, which was just incredible. It's where all the presidents stay and everywhere in Paris. And they took us there to stay. And then they showed me to my room. And I cannot begin to tell you, the room was bigger than my house that they put me in.
You had a suite.
It was unbelievably big, right? And then I remember Linford knocked the door and said, right, we're going shopping, you come in. I was like, oh, no. I'm just going to stay in. I'm just going to relax and just stay in. And so they all took off. And I sat on the bed and I just looked around this room. And I just burst into tears. Oh. I just burst into tears and I thought to myself, I've got all this just because I can run fast. I couldn't believe that this young boy who came from Llanedin, a council estate in Cardiff, was sitting in such opulence, in grandeur, that was historic. Mm. And I just burst into tears and it took me quite a long time to gather myself and go, well, do you know what? They must think you deserve it. So you know what? You're here to do your job. Do your job properly.
Yeah.
Do it tomorrow, you know, and perform, which I did. I went out and performed. So I still had those real, you know, yin and yang moments where it was like, I cannot believe this is my lifestyle. It was fabulous. You know, for a young man, it was just the best.
And it's funny kind of I can relate to that. It's what you might almost say, imposter syndrome. Why am I getting this kind of treatment?
Yeah.
This doesn't seem real.
It doesn't seem right. It just didn't seem right. But I was there and and perhaps if I'd gone shopping with the rest of the crew, it wouldn't even, you know, wouldn't even come into my mind.
Yeah,
but the fact
that
I was just like,
just
go, guys, because I just need just a moment. And I just burst into tears.
And that sort of magical period of being a superstar, winning medals, being famous, suddenly your earnings have taken off, you're staying in these incredible hotels. Were there any dark moments during those periods, or was it unadulterated high? Because one thing I know about you, I mean, we've met periodically through the years. We were at the Barcelona together at the Olympics in 92, Sydney in 2000. Yeah. We've bumped into each other at various other sort of sporting events. But you're an incredibly happy person. I mean, people will say, is he just this? Is he like this on TV and complete? I mean, there are people. I don't know if you found this. You see someone's television persona, and then you bump into them in a green room.
Yeah,
and they're totally
miserable.
Different. They're grumpy. They're nasty to the runners. They're spiteful. They don't really ask you any questions about you. It's all about them. And then they go on TV, and they're lovely.
Yeah,
they're
I
outgoing.
Know.
They're generous. And I'm like, this doesn't make sense. But you are exactly the same on television as you are in person, and you're a very happy, optimistic human being. I mean, there's no doubt about that. So the question I was going to... during these periods, when you're having this amazing life, you obviously had that moment of why me, but that was kind of tears in a funny kind of way of joy, if a bit of confusion. But was it all good? I mean, were there any negative stories? Was there anything that was challenging or difficult?
Yeah, there were. There were nothing... You cannot have, as I describe, a flawless life.
Right.
You know, I would say, when I look at my life, I would say, well, a life as we are today, I would say 96% was pretty good.
Yeah,
so I'm only tied like a fragment of it. And I don't dwell on those fragments of it. You know, I appreciate all the successful things that I had. But yeah, I remember when I fell out with the Federation over foolishness, as far as I was concerned. And I went to another meeting at the same time as the 3As. I ran 100 in the 3As, and then I didn't want to do the hurdles, and so I went to this other meeting in Italy, and I performed there, and then our hierarchy weren't happy the fact that I took off and went to Italy instead of running the hurdles in the championships. I was stubborn back in those days. I wasn't
the
easiest. And I was most probably stubborn. Not most probably, but I knew I was always stubborn because I was always hungry. And you know how hunger has your moods, right? So because I was like that, I was like, okay, well, if that's your case, I'm never, ever going to run for this country again. No problem. I'm not doing any television meetings. No problem. I've already got my gold medals. I already got my status. So you know what? If that's the way you want to be, that's the way you want to be. And this battle went on and on for some time. And the reason why they flew, I was training in Australia, and they flew somebody out from British Athletics to talk to me to Australia to try and...
No way.
To try and bring me back around in that sense. And do you know what changed my mind specifically was my grandmother. My nan said to me, oh, well, how am I going to watch you run on TV if you're not in these meetings?
Yeah.
And, you know, again, it's like, oh, yeah, you need sometimes those reality checks,
yeah,
those slaps
do.
In the faces
you
to
do,
say
yeah.
to you. And I was like,
it's what friendship's
oh,
about.
Oh, gosh.
Family, yeah.
Come on, God, put yourself together, son.
Yeah.
You know, what is it? This little trivia, he won't be around that long. And he wasn't. And then he won't be around that. And that argument will be done, dusted, and you'll be absolutely fine.
Yeah.
So that was one
that
little
was
thing.
Can I bring up one other thing, which I think a lot of people will be thinking, because I... remember vividly, you may do too, the Cohen Ovett rivalry, late 70s, early 80s. Cram coming in towards the end, Linford winning gold in 92, you winning the world championship, Sally Gunnell. I mean, athletics was part of the iconography, wasn't it, of Britain in the 70s and 80s. It was a beautiful thing. Mm. And do you remember the athletic theme tune on BBC? And then we would watch it and it would be like, wow. You know, we'd gather as a family around the TV set. Me and my brother would do laps of the block and we'd be measuring our time. It was really part of our culture. It could still be a part of our culture.
Oh, yeah.
But it's gone down a little bit for a very simple reason. Is that some of the heroes that we celebrated and some of the people who we idolised turned out to have taken drugs.
Yeah.
And I want to know what your perspective is on this, because you were part of this world, you're still a part of the world, you commentate on it. Where do you see the influence of drugs on how people watch the sport? How do you feel about people that you would have known and you subsequently found out they were taking drugs? How prevalent is it? What's your perspective on this issue?
Yeah, It's a tough one in this sense, because I always felt when I was young and up and coming, and I'm up and smiling again, which I should be smiling on this issue, but I am smiling because when I was up and coming, I can't begin to tell you how hard I worked, right?
No.
I worked hard. And I couldn't believe people were beating me. Right? That's why I'm smiling, right? Because I'm like, how is it possible for you to beat me? You must be on drugs.
Yeah.
They must be on drugs. That's the only reason they must be beating me. And then until you become a champion yourself and you realise that it was just time that you were missing, yeah, nothing else. And then all of a sudden, you're the world leader and you're thinking, oh yeah, well, I kind of did it without drugs, didn't I? So perhaps all those people back in the day that I was accusing were actually just better than me at that moment in time.
Yeah.
So straight away, then you kind of think, oh, okay, right. That's where you park that bit of it. But there is, as we know, that true ugly side of it in our sports in that sense. So I always think, first of all, optimistic as always, is that there are so many, and majority of performances we see on the track are done clean. I believe that. Yeah. I genuinely believe mm-hmm. that because mm-hmm. I've experienced it myself. Yeah, and being a champion or world record holder myself in that sense. So of course I think of that. But then there are those real negative sides of it as well. And I'm proud of our sport, that our sport is willing to take the hit, because it's really awful press when another superstar in sport gets dope test positive, right? So I'm really positive about our sport that's willing to take that hit to expose these drug cheats. That is really important for me, because also the lessons that are learned from youngsters is that we don't tolerate it. And if we don't catch up with you today, we will catch you tomorrow. Yeah. And so you may think you're getting away with it, and you will get away with it to a certain extent, but the reality is we will ultimately come for you. Now, I'm really harsh on it as well, and I would like them to see that they take all the proceeds that you had from your sport when you were banned taking drugs, taken off you, like they would nearly do in the real world.
Because it's a kind of fraud, isn't it?
It is fraud. People have gone, look at yourself, you as a kid, you invested time into watching athletics. And hang on a minute, you should be compensated for your time. People who go into the stadiums to watch great performances, if people are dope test positive, why are you there? You wouldn't want to be there to celebrate and support that. So you're absolutely being conned out of your good money that you've earned. People who raise money for sponsorships, shoe brands that contribute to you to make you better in that sense. I would get all of that back. And if it was some way that they could get it back, they certainly should. Because they're being rewarded by cheating other people.
And you know, just picking up on that, we often focus on the fans who have been defrauded.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the other athletes who may have run clean, who have not had their moment of glory,
absolutely,
haven't earned that money,
absolutely,
haven't had that trajectory that you've discussed because someone has decided to break the rules. But there is another really interesting consequence of drug taking that we don't talk about very much.
Go on.
And that is clean athletes who live under a shadow of suspicion. Because how could they have done what they did if they were clean?
Yeah.
Now, have you experienced any of that?
Yes.
Go on. How does that feel?
Just down the street, mate, on Oxford Street.
Today? Today?
No, not today. Oh, I'm in a good mood. That's what I'm on today. Right. Can you remember when the Dwayne Chambers saga was all going on?
Yeah.
That was big news in that sense. Anyway, I was in Oxford Street. I was walking and this guy was with his girlfriend. And I was just minding my business. I walked down. This guy stopped me, pulled me back. He stopped me. He went, Colin. I was like, hey, how are you doing? He said, oh, brilliant stuff. Absolutely fantastic to see you here. Turned to his girlfriend. He said to her, Colin Jackson here, one of our greatest athletes ever. And he's clean. And then the girl turned, while I'm standing there, she turned to him and went, well, that's what he said.
Really?
If looks could have killed, she'd have been 6 foot under rapidly at that particular stage. I was so annoyed, right, that... And I thought to myself, this is all because of this circumstance with Dwayne.
Yeah.
And it's in the public eye. Mm. And anybody who's been successful at that time was, or any time, was being... Fingers were pointed at. And it really annoyed me. And I thought to myself, do you know what? How can we repair your reputation in that sense? I can't, you know, and I think people who believe that will always believe it. And people who don't believe it will always not believe it.
That must be horrifying.
Awful. Awful. Awful.
If you've done it right, you've worked, you've gone through the hard yards, and there are people who you can never convince, because you can't prove it, can you?
No,
there's nothing you can do to prove a sceptic.
No, 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 there's nothing you can do. And I think you can't even waste your time trying to. You just got to let them be who they are and think to yourself, what is going on in your life while you're just totally thinking so negative completely about somebody you don't even know?
Hmm.
I mean, they don't know, you know? And I think to myself, it is the most frustrating thing for clean athletes to deal with, is when you're accused of something. You know, if I want to smash my reputation, I'll do it myself, right? I don't need, you know, anybody who is associated with anything to smash my reputation. I'll do it myself.
Mm.
But when you work hard for something in an honest manner, and when you accuse, and this is words my grandfather said to him, or said to me. He said to me when I was just coming up on the world, and there's always that kind of, you know, suspicion of what's going on, you know, in that doping field. And he said to me, you know, remember, if you don't know any decent people, I do.
Hmm.
And you've got to think about that, what somebody says to you that way. And then you realise how your success is having an effect on your extended family, your extended friends. Can you imagine? Every time I was successful, for example, I'm winning titles and winning medals, my grandfather was, you know, hat on, proud, jacket on, down to his club. He'd get down to his club, they'd all be buying him drinks.
Yeah.
They'd be celebrating with him. Mm. That circumstance. Can you imagine if I was busted for drugs?
Yeah.
What that would do to his life?
Yeah.
He couldn't go back down that club.
Mm.
He couldn't. He couldn't face it.
Do you think that's the way to get athletes all around the world to not take drugs? Do you think it's a question of having values?
Values and
almost morals. more than yeah, detection.
Absolutely.
It's just knowing that Kirsty Wade, she competed at a time when, so she's a middle distance runner, where many of the Eastern Europeans were taking drugs. And I asked her, and she said, it never crossed my mind to take drugs. It just, because of the values that I had,
yes,
the family I grew up in.
Yes.
She said, for me, taking steroids wasn't a temptation. Chocolate digestives were a temptation, but not steroids. It was almost like it was a line she couldn't
cross. Yeah, yeah. No, I totally
even
get that.
Even if she knew she would get away with it.
Yeah, yeah. No, I totally get that. And I do think it's that kind of the real values that you hold.
Mm.
You know, ultimately, I always say, I know I can go to bed at night knowing I worked hard and I got every ounce, every accolade I got was from, can't just say from my hard work, right? My coaches and the friends, your family, all they put in time and effort in for you as well. But you know what? It was done in the purest fashion.
Yeah.
Hard work, graft, dedication, commitment, and deliverance.
Yes.
Deliverance when it matters. And to me, those are the things that I can go to bed with happily every single night. And you wonder why I smile every day? It's simple.
And it seems to me that the family is crucial in all of this. What Number they, one. The values they surrounded you with, the support they've given you. I want to transition now into, you came out as gay 2 or 3 years ago.
Mm.
And I know that your family, when they found out, they were supportive.
Yeah.
They backed you up.
Yeah.
So the question I was going to ask is, did you feel during your athletics career that you're the family of athletics or the wider family of British culture wouldn't be supportive? What was your reluctance, or were you not that reluctant? You just didn't feel that it was something that was for other people to know about?
That was like a real, I like that way you put all the, I didn't care. I think this is one of the things, when you don't have care for something, then it doesn't resonate with you in that sense. So I wasn't going to be out there flying a flag or waving around. I was only going to do my running. That's all I was interested in. And my family, who knew, were new, and they were always around me. So there was, to me, that all that really mattered.
Mm.
So nothing really mattered. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. So in other words, that's just part of who you are.
Yeah.
Why should you go and broadcast it?
I wasn't interested.
I didn't go and tell a journalist I'm heterosexual.
No.
It's just part of who I am.
Yeah. So for me, it was, you know, you can imagine you're put in this position here. So when I was in the Clion, for example, in that sense, I'm put in that position to go and race, right? And run. And that's all I do. So everything I was here, so I'd be in front of a journalist. Not because I was gay, I was in front of the journalists because I was a runner.
Yeah.
So that's all I'm there to talk about. I have nothing else of relevance to chat to anything, you know, anybody about.
The reason I mention it is because, so when I was in Barcelona, 92, Sydney, I got hanging around with a few of the athletes. Mm. And it was in a funny kind of way, it was quite a macho culture.
Yeah, yeah. Sport, right?
Sport. So actually, funnily enough, I was going to say table tennis was like that, but I thought you would laugh at me. Ping pong. But it was very kind of stereotypically masculine, and it was about getting laid and pulling women. And it was a lot of the conversation centred around that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I wondered what that would have been like for somebody who's a brilliant athlete, who has a different sexual orientation. Was that, did you see that as jarring? How did you cope with that? Because there'll be a lot of young people listening in who may be questioning their sexuality, thinking it through, yeah. wondering who they are, yeah. trying to find their voice. And I think they'd be fascinated to know how you dealt with some of these sort of ironies.
Yeah, I think I was so... And this is, it just sounds like a cop-out, but it's not a cop-out, because it's the truth. I was so engrossed in performance that nothing was going to knock me off kilter. And so even when, you know, I like my music, and that was brilliant, and I enjoyed, you know, when we were going out to clubs, I enjoyed going out to clubs in that sense, but I didn't want any distractions.
Yeah.
So I was one of those people who would watch, right, people, and how they formed their relationships, it was always a distraction for them. It was always a distraction. And they were in bad moods. They were like, yeah, I was like, you know what? I just don't want any of that. I just want to stay level, focused on what I need to do, because performance was was the only, and it sounds weird, it was the only thing I had. But because I fell into it, if I didn't perform in that sense, then I would have nothing.
Yeah,
I felt that was my internal thing saying to me, if you don't perform, you haven't got anything. So I was always solely just focused on my sport, on my performance, and whatever I wanted to do at that particular moment in time. So I was never knocked off my kilter in any particular way. Because I'm quite sensitive. I guess, you know, if I'm bursting into tears in a hotel room, you can tell that I'm, you know, things register, things that they do go on. But I also got that hard, steely side as well, which is necessary. So you've always got to just keep that kind of balance right, always too. So I always was happy who I was, you know. That was, there was never a dispute there for me. And
so
I
you were always comfortable in your identity?
Always.
It wasn't a struggle?
Always.
It wasn't like, oh gosh, I wish I was something other than I am?
No.
From a young age, you knew who you were.
Never.
And you were happy and comfortable with that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think if you keep your purity in that sense and that confidence in you do, you're allowed to grow up and you're allowed to develop. I had this kind of... The whole, well, it's not network is the wrong word to do, but I had this huge duvet, this blanket that was always over me and protected me. That's what I always felt. So I was always secure. I was always safe. And that is really important. And I realised not everybody gets that, you know. So I don't want to say I was spoiled, because people may say you were spoiled, but I was well looked after. That's the word I want to use.
Do you mean by the social community?
Everything. Yeah. You know, from my parents to my friends to my coach to my training partners to they always seemed like there was people who
on your side.
Always.
Yeah.
Always.
And you were hugely popular in the.
You know, there was nothing for me to worry about or anything like that. And I think again, when you're in that environment, you are so lucky.
And were they aware of?
Oh yeah,
so that was well known in the athletics.
Yeah. So it was fine. So that's that's the best thing.
And last thing on this, and my sense, but I'd love to hear your sense, is that we're becoming more tolerant. That in 20 years' time, this conversation wouldn't even happen.
Yeah,
it just wouldn't be an issue.
I agree that,
the fact that we're discussing it means it probably is still a bit of an issue for some people.
Yeah.
And if you, for example, I mean, this is unbelievable.
I think it's an era thing.
It's an era thing. Yeah. But think of this. Think of the number of footballers there are in the world.
Yeah.
In professional leagues. I'm not sure that there has ever been an openly gay, active. Male footballer.
Yeah.
That is staggering to me. There are people who find it difficult to be open about who they are, even with their teammates, by the way, people that they're living with day in, day out, because there is still, I think, a stigma attached to it. Do you think that's a fair analysis?
Yeah, I still think there'd be a stigma, and not in a positive way, because I remember I was laughing when I did an interview with a friend of mine, Kaiser, about a kiss and tell story. So she was telling me about, you know, about this, talk about this kiss and tell story. So I did that. And then I forgot about it. Cause I did this story like in February, March or something like this with Kaiser. And then I was away in Switzerland. And then I had all these phone calls, people saying to me, oh, you've come out. And I was like, what? And I was like, I didn't even know what you're talking about. Then all of a sudden, my friends were ringing me from LA, from Las Vegas, from Canada. Seriously, really? It hit news all over the world. And I was like, wow. Okay, I didn't think I was that relevant. I really didn't. But it did. It hit across the planet. And I thought to myself, I can understand now why an active footballer wouldn't necessarily want to come out in that sense. Because if you just want to concentrate on your sport or you sort of focus on your teamwork and everything, you shouldn't have to be to deal with all of this.
Yes.
And this is the reason why I'd say to... And I'd honestly say that. It's not necessary for you to come out in that sense. Do what you want to do.
Yeah.
And just live your life the way you want to live it. Mm. Don't be horrible to people. Don't be miserable to people. Do what you want to do and stay lawful. You know, things I'd always say to do. And then whatever happens, happens.
Yeah.
You know, keep it clear in that sense. And so
almost like the first person who takes a step is going to be surrounded.
Yeah.
And it could destabilise their footballing
team. And they may not want that type of publicity. Right. And we're saying that type of publicity. They may be just... quiet now. Yeah. They don't have to be a superstar of a sport. They don't want to be a superstar of sport. They just want to do their business, which is just play their sport. Yeah. But you can imagine, as you say, there'd be such a massive focus continuously on every angle, you know? And I think that in itself would be difficult to deal with. And I was thinking, if I was a competing athlete, I would have found it very distracting for me.
Yeah.
So for me, that's why I say when you don't see any major footballers in that sense, it'd be like, yeah, no, I totally understand how they would feel.
Yeah. And just sort of coming towards the end of the interview, loved the chat, by the way.
Yeah.
Brilliant. So where are you today? What's the future? What are you doing? What's going on in your life?
Do you know what? I think, you know, we mentioned this word happy, and I think to myself...
Are you happy?
I would say, I always think happiness is a moment, right? I'm really content with my life.
Are you?
I think that is the most important thing, is to sit back and go, I am really content. Because, you know, what makes you happy is like, I just had a lovely cup of coffee. That made me happy, right? You know, that was great to see. But you got to be content. Yeah. And I think everybody should strive for that feeling of contentment where you just sit back and reflect and go, you know what?
I don't think I've got
all
that.
Good.
I think I struggle with happiness as well. What is it?
Yeah.
What does it consist in? And I'm often looking for the next thing.
Yeah, that is what happiness can do. I mean, if you're content, you won't even do it. Remember this, right? I always say this to people. Choice is the devil, right? Look at what you've got and appreciate it. And also look and think, have I maximised to the very last drop what I've got? Because what I look around and people are doing, I don't think they do. I think they go about 20% and everything, and then they're looking for something new. They're looking for something different. They're looking for a change. Guys, look a little past that 20, 30, 40% and you start to see how things change within your field, within the projects that you're working on. You know, find something that's a tiny, that you have a little bit of a spark, that's a passion for. Then you engage.
And you're learning to swim
now.
And
you do that. I'm learning to swim right now. You know, I want to be able to swim by this time next year. I want to be able to swim between 400, 500, 600. Everybody says to me, if you can swim 400 metres, you'll basically swim a mile. So there's no problem. But I want to learn to swim and I want to swim well, so that I can be comfortable and confident in what I'm doing when I'm around water. Yes. And then I've already said, next year, I'm going to learn to horse ride.
No way!
Exactly.
Really?
Now, where's this coming
That's
from?
Brilliant.
Look
I love
at
it.
Me.
I
you
love
know,
it.
What are you talking about? You want to learn to horse ride? No, already. So I've gone, okay, this is this kind of goal, and I know I'm going to achieve that. Why do I know I'm going to learn to swim? Because sweet people swim. I'm not going to be doing anything outstanding in that sense. People can swim. Yeah. That means I can learn to swim.
Quite right.
Horse ride. I want a horse ride. Why? Do you know what? Why not? Why not?
I've never done it. I'm intrigued by it.
Why not? Just give it a go.
Yeah, quite
and
right.
See what it's like.
Got to keep it fresh. This has been a joy. Last question.
Yes,
ask
hit me.
Everyone
yeah.
in this series of interviews. The Times,
yeah.
they have what's called, this is a bit of a depressing question, but they have something called the obituary section. Mm. And they're quite famous. They kind of chronicle the great lives of people in our country and beyond our country. What would you like your obituary to say about you?
I'd say that I was always smiling. I tend to be, 99% of the time, I was always in a good place. And I had a positive impact on people's lives.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Pleasure.
This episode of Lifetimes has been presented by me, Matthew Side, and produced by Lucy Lavery. To listen to household names speak as you've never heard them before, please subscribe to the podcast. Search for Lifetimes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favourite podcast app. And if you like it, please rate and review the series.
Lifetimes is a Times Newspapers production. To find more of our great journalism, go online at thetimes.co.uk.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.